Welcome to Biotech Matters, presented by Blue Star Bioadvisors. I'm Jeff Feinberg. On our last episode, I sat down with Dr. Beatrice Goylav to hear about what she's looking out for at ASN Kidney Week in Philadelphia. During that conversation, we discussed what she hoped to see from some recently completed and ongoing trials in IgA nephropathy, including data with Filspari, also known as sparsentan, Tarpeyo, also known as budesonide, atrasentan, and emerging mechanisms such as APRIL and BAFF. Indeed, there were several sessions dedicated to IgA nephropathy, including high-impact clinical trial presentations and industry-sponsored educational symposia. Most notably, data from the PROTECT trial with sparsentan was presented. And as mentioned in my discussion with Dr. Goylav, Novartis put out a press release indicating positive data with atrasentan. These studies and all things IgA nephropathy coming out of Kidney Week are the topics of today's discussion, which we will dive into with my guest, Dr. Pietro Canetta. Dr. Canetta, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here, Jeff.
Perhaps you can start by introducing yourself.
Sure. My name is Pietro Canetta. I'm an associate professor of medicine and nephrology at Columbia University Irving Medical Center in New York City. And I practice as part of Glomerular Disease Center. And so my clinical and research focus is on patients with glomerular diseases. And so I see patients in the office, treat them, and participate in various forms of research, especially clinical and translational research. And I and my colleagues like to participate in clinical trials, including some of the clinical trials that you mentioned, actually, clinical trials of targeted budesonide and of sparsentan and IgA nephropathy in particular.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. So in addition to your background, I also wanted to have you on the podcast because I attended your lecture at Kidney Week, Emerging Therapeutic Options in IgA Nephropathy, during the educational symposium, IgA Nephropathy, Proteinuria, Vasoactive Peptides, and the Evolving Treatment Landscape. For our listeners, would you mind just providing a brief summary of your presentation or provide the main takeaways regarding the novel drug classes you highlighted, endothelin A receptor antagonists, SGLT2 inhibitors, and novel glucocorticoids?
It was a session, as you said, sort of dedicating to looking at the future of nephrology. And this is of IgA nephrology, particularly as it relates to treating IgA nephropathy. And this is a very exciting time because of all of the published and ongoing clinical trials and novel types of drugs that we are studying for IgA nephropathy in particular. So in this session, my role was to discuss sort of the clinical treatments that are emerging. It's a big topic. I only had 20 minutes. So it was a challenge to get through everything I wanted to say. But the highlights that I tried to bring up, first of all, is just very briefly to go over where we are as far as what is still considered the baseline of our approach. And in the KDIGO guidelines, which are now a couple of years old, but have focused on supportive care. And some of the approaches that we have actually that we're using increasingly now, like SGLT2 inhibitors, and one could argue endothelin antagonists as well, are really part of that supportive care paradigm. And then layering on top of that, there's increasingly sort of more intensive types of medications, immunosuppressive medications. I think it's still worth mentioning the history of steroids in this disease, glucocorticoids specifically, because of their broad anti-inflammatory and immunosuppressive effects, which I think are important in a disease that affects the immune system or involves the immune system in many different ways: complement, innate immunity, and adaptive immunity as well, antibody production, inflammation, et cetera. And then on top of that, trying to harness some of the benefits that we've seen, the kidney benefits, with avoiding some of the really problematic side effects of steroids. And so with that, we've seen the approach of targeted budesonide, which is a mucosal steroid. It affects the gut, really, but has a far reduced systemic absorption and is now FDA approved for IgA nephropathy, first drug FDA approved for IgA nephropathy in the United States. Very exciting. As well as the other emerging options. And I think in particular, kind of broadly speaking, the two very broad categories are agents that target the APRIL and BAFF pathway of B-cell activation and agents that target the complement cascade across many different ways, but broadly speaking, complement as well.
Thank you. So let's start with sparsentan, branded as Filspari, which was front and center at this conference, including the presentation of the much anticipated data from the PROTECT trial. So the drug was also studied for FSGS in the DUPLEX trial, and those results were shared at the same session. I think the general sense is that the results favor sparsentan and IgA nephropathy, but are maybe neutral in FSGS. Is this your interpretation of the data, and what are the implications for Filspari going forward?
Yeah, so this has generated a lot of talk and interest, as you've said. It was an exciting session. So I can tell you, you know, I am a participant in the PROTECT trial as far as we enrolled patients at our site. I was actually the local PI, and then in the same in DUPLEX, and I was actually on the one of the co-authors on that DUPLEX paper. So, you know, the results have to be interpreted, I think, in light of the study design and of the primary outcomes. And I think what you're highlighting or what you're alluding to is that in the PROTECT data, which has now been published actually in The Lancet, what we saw was a substantial decrease in the proteinuria, which in IgA nephropathy in particular, you know, the FDA has accepted as a reasonable surrogate outcome to allow drug development, which is really a big part of why we're seeing so much interest in this disease, because we have a surrogate outcome where you can at 36 weeks really assess the potential value of a drug. So the proteinuria was really, really, and we already knew, I think, from the earlier data that would be true, and it seemed to be sustained. And then there was the sort of more substantial, more long-term event, which was a change in the slope of the GFR, which is its own sort of surrogate outcome, because the real outcome we're trying to prevent in IgA nephropathy specifically is kidney transplant and dialysis. So there in PROTECT, it's a little tricky because there's different ways to look at the GFR over time, and specifically with slope, there's both total slope and chronic slope. And you can get into the nitty-gritty of the drug agencies, the FDA versus the European agency, and which slope is more important. And there seemed to be, both for the total and the chronic slope, about a 1 mL/min change favoring sparsentan in the study, but the statistical significance of those results from just a simple p-value approach for the total slope was a p of 0.06, so not statistically significant. For the GF chronic slope, it was 0.04 in PROTECT. And those two numbers are very similar, of course. So it means that the certainty about the difference in the eGFR is not so unlike, they're not so unlike each other between the GFR total and GFR chronic slopes. The difference with the DUPLEX trial, which you mentioned, which was published at the same time in the New England Journal of Medicine, is in the DUPLEX trial's different patient population. The DUPLEX trial was really intended to be primary FSGS, and we can quibble over how well we define primary FSGS. But what we saw is similar to the PROTECT study, the DUPLEX study randomized to sparsentan or irbesartan. So it's sort of ARB versus sparsentan, which has ARB, it has angiotensin receptor blockade as well as endothelin blockade. So you're sort of seeing the effects. You can think of it as the endothelin plus effects. And in the DUPLEX study of FSGS, the FSGS patients, again, saw a decrease in proteinuria, although the difference in proteinuria was not quite as great in the FSGS patients as it was. It still favored sparsentan. And what was not really seen was a change in GFR over time, actually. And there it was, you know, there was perhaps a numerical difference that favored sparsentan in the chronic slope. And the total slope was really, really quite similar, but both of them were, you know, the confidence intervals were plenty wide enough that there was not a convincing difference between the two. So I think we're seeing the biggest difference between those studies. The design of the study is actually very similar. The biggest difference is really the degree of proteinuria reduction and then the patient population really underlying them. And so there may be something about the patients in the DUPLEX study and that are being called primary FSGS that they don't get as much of a benefit as those in the PROTECT study of IgA nephropathy.
That's all really interesting. And I think we want to, you know, put a flag there and come back to that sort of comparative, you know, element to it. But I think immediately, any thoughts on what's going to happen to the Filspari label more immediately? I mean, of course, this was, you know, the FDA required that they do this sort of confirmatory study following the conditional approval. So, you know, is it your best guess that they'll at least get the full approval for IgA nephropathy?
Yeah, that's a very exciting question right now that has, I think, a lot of people on the edge of their seats, including, you know, patients who are perhaps have been started on sparsentan or FILSPARI for IgA nephropathy during this period of conditional approval, and they and their doctors are maybe wondering, are they going to be able to stay on it? And the short answer is, I don't know. I mean, I think strictly by the letter of the expectation, I think the sparsentan did not meet the pre-specified sort of cutoff that the FDA had requested to be useful as a drug to gain the full approval. But it was close, and it's such a subtle difference. And, you know, for example, the European agency had a different expectation, and the same exact trial, same exact patients met the European agency. So I honestly have no particular insight into what the FDA will do. I hope that they at least look closely at the data, and I would hope that even if everyone agrees that it didn't meet the expectation, that they recognize that it's close enough that it might be worth doing additional study here and not closing the door completely. But it's anybody's guess right now.
Yeah. Well, to what degree also does the sort of like longer follow-up period and the safety that was demonstrated there also play a role?
Yeah, I think the safety is reassuring because there wasn't really any big major safety concerns.
Right.
And as some of the listeners may know, and anybody who's used this drug, there is a REMS program and for FILSPARI, for sparsentan. And thankfully, there was not a particular signal in this study or really in DUPLEX either, for example, for liver toxicity, which is one of the aspects of the REMS program. So I think that's reassuring. And I think it's reassuring that we're probably not doing harm by keeping people on the drugs. And so if we're not doing harm, then really just comes down to, you know, can we spend the money to do the research and to get more longer-term data?
Right. So you opened your talk reflecting on the 3 Ds of treatment goals: death, dialysis, and doubling of serum creatinine, which historically have informed clinical studies, including IgA nephropathy studies. As of late, there has been a shift to focus on surrogate markers to predict these things, right, which you alluded to, including in PROTECT and DUPLEX studies. So specifically, as you mentioned, these studies look at changes in proteinuria from baseline alongside a longer follow-up period to observe the impact on the eGFR decline, which you also mentioned is in some ways also a sort of surrogate, but of maybe fewer degrees of separation away from the 3 Ds I just mentioned. So basically the question is, you know, what might these results of these studies tell us about the surrogacy of proteinuria on, you know, so to speak, harder outcomes in kidney disease? And is it possible that it matters which flavor of disease we're talking about? In other words, is it possible that proteinuria is a better surrogate for eventual eGFR decline in glomerular diseases that are not thought of as particularly nephrotic or proteinuric, but far less predictive in diseases in which patients may have nephrotic range proteinuria or nephrotic syndrome, but still progress slowly? So what might this mean for the use of proteinuria as a viable endpoint in future studies?
Yeah, and I'll add one element to what you said to complicate things even further. What about the mechanism of reduction of proteinuria? So right now, we really think that the proteinuria is an important prognostic factor in many kidney diseases. And that, I think, goes without saying. I mean, that's been shown definitively in IgA nephropathy and FSGS, in membranous with nephropathy with certain other, you know, cutoffs, but clearly proteinuria has incredible importance as a prognostic marker. And I don't think anybody really argues that. The question is a decrease in proteinuria always going to be associated with an improvement in long-term outcomes? And so this is disease specific for sure. There's disease specific implications of what changes in proteinuria mean. It depends on the degree of change of proteinuria. So for example, you could say a patient with, say, membranous nephropathy and nephrotic syndrome, and if you change the urine protein from 12 grams to 7 grams a day, well, you'd say, well, that's a big decrease. It's 5 grams less. It's nearly a 50% decrease. But does that really impact the patient's experience and the long-term outcomes, and is that a good enough outcome? And most nephrologists would say, no, it's not. So there's those types of questions, and then layered on top of it, what about how you're decreasing the proteinuria? So in IgA nephropathy, where we've really thankfully had this ability to step back from the death dialysis and doubling of creatinine, which takes a long time. And even though it's a pretty good acknowledged outcome that we should be striving to avoid, the fact that it takes so long hamstrings our ability to develop drugs because of the costs and the time. And it also means that the patient sitting in front of us, if we're depending on that, does not have a whole lot of hope for seeing new therapies come out in any sort of reasonable time course. So in IgA nephropathy, where we have proteinuria, we can say now we can use this because we think it's pretty good. And we actually have published data to show that reduction in proteinuria is associated with improvement in outcomes. Well, when you look at that data, the majority of that data actually comes from trials with corticosteroids. So does that mean that we're going to see that same relationship with every other type of agent, regardless of mechanism of action? I'll add in there ACE inhibitors, ARBs. Those, we have a lot of data where proteinuria reduction seems to translate to long-term benefits. So I think this is actually very complicated. But I think it does take a little bit of willingness to accept imperfect outcomes in order to allow development, with the humble acknowledgement that this may not be completely definitive, but at least it'll let us chart a path forward with the appropriate checks and balances to confirm that what we think is beneficial is actually beneficial. And so in IgA nephropathy, I think it's a successful strategy when you look at the field. We've allowed drugs to be developed. We've allowed drugs to come to market, and we have a lot more drugs now in development. It does not mean that it's a simple, one fix. And we do still, one-time fix for the problem. We do still need to do the work on the back end to make sure that the drugs that we think are beneficial, that we're following the patients to ensure that that's the case.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So it sounds like, if I could sort of play that back a little bit, it's really that we have separate data that strongly suggests that a reduction in proteinuria is beneficial and is associated with better long-term outcomes across a variety of mechanisms. And at least in IgA, one sort of, maybe it's positive, maybe it's not, study does not invalidate the notion that proteinuria is, reduction in proteinuria is both beneficial and still likely prognostic of better long-term outcomes. And then really it's to what degree that can be further extended to other forms of kidney disease. We're also not going to say that the DUPLEX study says that it can't be. It may be, maybe not. And as you're alluding to, maybe the mechanism becomes a little bit more important. But in the meantime, on balance, it seems it's better to continue to try to help these patients and try to bring better therapies to market. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that is fair. And I think the fact that we're seeing sort of big studies that are now challenging to interpret the results, I hope this doesn't mean that we'll somehow step back on our efforts to study these drugs. Now, of course, you can open the tap and you can close the tap, and you can regulate the flow of new drugs, new drug applications, depending on how high you set the bar. And that's for the regulatory agencies really to decide. But if it seems like, we've set the bar too low, you can always set a higher bar for proteinuria or set a higher bar for differences in GFR, if you need to feel more confident in the effects of the drug under study. So I think there's ways to find a common ground and to find a useful way forward, because the problems that we're having now compared to 5 years ago, these are great problems to have. We're talking about two approved drugs. We're talking about other drugs coming down the pipeline, which 10 years ago for sure were sort of a hard to imagine utopia for patients and doctors who are really staring at not a whole lot of options in front of them.
Yeah. And I would be remiss if I didn't also ask you about atrasentan. Of course, we don't have the full data yet, but I'm sure you're aware that it's also in development for IgA nephropathy and that the drug has recapitulated the effect on proteinuria that was demonstrated with sparsentan. So the main difference, of course, between atrasentan and sparsentan is that the former lacks the activity as an ARB that you mentioned. And so what do you expect for atrasentan going forward? How do you think about it in the context of sparsentan?
Yeah, and I think that I'm not part of the study. The drug was being developed by Chinook, which was bought by Novartis. So I'm not part of that phase three study. I think one of the big things that I look at when I see the results, and we don't have nearly as much data with atrasentan. We had some data that was presented at ASN Kidney Week, actually last year in 2022, at the World Congress of Nephrology earlier this year. And then we have the press release really kind of top line saying that the results look positive. My big takeaways are, number one, that there's hope for a class effect here. And, you know, from the company side, every company wants to distinguish its product. But from a biological plausibility side, and particularly if you want to convince, I think, the community that these drugs have hope, it's actually good to see multiple drugs in the class having effect. Because there was questions that came up atrasentan when it was studied in the SONAR study for diabetic nephropathy. There was questions that came, you know, that raised a lot of questions. It's obviously not approved for diabetic nephropathy. There was questions about fluid retention, heart failure, et cetera. And would the potential benefits outweigh the potential risks? So I think it's good to see that the proteinuria reduction was substantial. It was like what they've presented was like over a 50% decrease, I think, in the first year. And that really, to me, says, well, this is a drug class that is worth taking a close look at. And as they did after the SONAR study, trying to understand where the drug class might be useful. So if it looks like it might not be right for a general diabetic nephropathy patient, maybe there's another sort of patient, like an IgA nephropathy patient, where the risk-benefit ratio actually shifts because of the underlying morbidities and shifts more towards benefit. So I was pleased to see that. I think I would have been, had there not been that benefit in the proteinuria, that would actually make me even more pessimistic about sparsentan. The fact that there is that benefit of proteinuria, you know, makes me a little bit more optimistic about the class of drugs as a whole. You know, the other thing is that once you have more than one drug in a class, if you can have more than one drug approved, it tends to, you know, generate competition and drive down prices. And I think that's probably good for patients and for insurers and payers. So that's not necessarily a bad thing either.
Yeah, yeah. So another point you highlighted in your lecture is the four-hit hypothesis of IgA nephropathy and that the complexity of this disease process increases the opportunity for intervention. So in addition to background RAS inhibitors and the endothelins that we've been talking about, there are other available or in-development mechanisms, including the SGLT2 inhibitors, the novel glucocorticoids, which we also discussed, complement inhibitors, which you mentioned earlier, and APRIL and BAFF targeting agents, right? Things that target B cells. So let's start with the SGLT2 inhibitors and IgA nephropathy. Where is this class of drugs going in terms of reshaping the treatment paradigm? And what might it do to meet some of the remaining unmet need after Filspari?
Yeah, so I think these drugs are really broadly effective in proteinuric chronic kidney disease. Where they kind of fit in for IgA nephropathy, if you think about the four-hit hypothesis, is very solidly at the very end of hit four. I mean, they're working on glomerular hyperfiltration and ameliorating glomerular hemodynamics and hyperfiltration. They are complementary to ACE inhibitors or ARBs. And that combination, I think, in proteinuria kidney disease is clearly better than either alone. So these drugs are here. They're here to stay. They're great drugs. They're very safe, even safer in non-diabetics than they are in diabetics. So what does that do? Does it answer an unmet need? Well, it helps slow down disease progression. So that is a benefit. When you ask patients, what do you hope for, patients with IgA nephropathy? Most of them will not say, well, I hope that you can slow down my disease from, you know, needing a transplant in 10 years to needing a transplant in 15 years. That's still a great outcome for a scientist and for a researcher. But for a patient, you know, they really want to hear about a cure. So to what degree does it meet an unmet need? I mean, it certainly helps patients or helps population of patients. They're not curative. And I think it's clear if you treat patients with proteinuria kidney disease that they can improve outcomes substantially. But with a long enough time course, these patients are still progressing.
Mm-hmm.
So that really kind of, in one sense, one of the downsides as a researcher is in any sort of controlled study is that they're going to probably reduce outcomes in the control arm. And that's great for patients, of course, but it means it's a little bit harder to show additional benefit. You might have to have, you know, a larger number of patients, larger time course for follow-up.
Right. No, that's a good consideration for all the ongoing or future trials that are planned. But by the same token, it sounds like there's still very much the need to continue doing these studies because, you know, SGLT2 inhibitors, while beneficial, won't be the end all. So let's leave aside budesonide, you know, the novel glucocorticoid branded as Tarpeyo, and the complement inhibitors, because I think we could probably dedicate another hour to that. So let's discuss APRIL and BAFF inhibition. So you ended your talk highlighting this pathway, and indeed, there were data presented separately at Kidney Week on this mechanism, the most prominent of which is probably sibeprenlimab. So for our listeners, sibeprenlimab is an IgG2 monoclonal antibody against APRIL, which was studied for IgA nephropathy in the ENVISION study. Briefly, the study randomized 155 IgA nephropathy patients at a 1:1:1:1 ratio to receive monthly doses of IV sibeprenlimab at 2, 4, 6, or 8 mg per kg or placebo for 12 months. The main results show a geometric mean ratio reduction from baseline in the 24-hour UPCR favors sibeprenlimab by approximately 2.5 to 3-fold in a dose-dependent manner. Least squares mean change from baseline in eGFR also favors sibeprenlimab by as much as 7-fold in a roughly dose-dependent manner. And there are other APRIL/BAFF targeting assets in the development for IgA nephropathy. So given this early data, how promising is this class? And where might it fit within the evolving treatment paradigm? To what extent is the fact that these drugs are infused or injectable a factor in a treatment approach with almost exclusively oral therapies?
Yeah, there's at least, you know, 4 or 5 in development in various stages. That was a really exciting paper to come out during ASN Kidney Week, published in New England Journal of Medicine that you describe. I think there's a lot of justified excitement over these drugs. So there's sort of two big flavors. The APRIL and BAFF are separate B-cell stimulating molecules and pathways. And so you can block just some agents block just APRIL. Some agents block APRIL and BAFF together. There's actually other agents that block BAFF without APRIL. One is approved for lupus, belimumab, although BAFF alone is not being developed for IgA nephropathy right now, to my knowledge. So the genetic studies that have been done, or many done by my colleagues at Columbia, or at least helmed by my colleagues at Columbia, have really strongly indicated APRIL as being an important locus in the genetic studies of risk of IgA nephropathy. So I think there's good evidence from the genetic studies that APRIL, clear evidence from genetic studies that APRIL is important in the disease pathogenesis. And then there's some basic science models that show that the APRIL is important, the manipulation of it is important. And BAFF works in some overlapping ways with APRIL to stimulate B cells. And I think all of these drugs are exciting for a few reasons, especially because they're different from what we have. They work in a different part of the disease pathway. If you talk about the four-hit hypothesis, they're much, much more proximal. We're talking about HIF2 and the production of antibodies. They are dosed differently. So instead of being pills, they're giving mostly as sub-Q injections is mostly how they're being developed every 2 or 4 weeks. And that has, you know, pluses and minuses, of course. Some patients will not like that, but some patients will like the idea of, instead of having to take a pill every day, the opportunity to do an injection every few weeks, and the rest of the time actually not having it at the top of their mind. And it might actually be a way to increase adherence, particularly, you know, in the IgA nephropathy population, which is often, you know, early adulthood, starting families, working, you know, busy people with jobs and families, et cetera. So I think that and then the other thing is that the preliminary data that's come out of certainly that sibeprenlimab study, other studies of, for example, atacicept, it's another agent now called zigakibart. These are all very pronounceable names that they come up with. The preliminary data shows not just proteinuria reduction, but they've actually, several of these studies have shown decreases in an important molecule called galactose-deficient IgA1, which is the form of IgA that is actually depositing in the kidneys and sort of predisposing to inflammation. And they can actually show that this biomarker decreases with treatment. So that actually lends to biological plausibility. Proteinuria is very nice, but it's very kind of rough as estimate of kind of a lot of different things that can produce it. This is a little bit of a more specific, more nuanced biomarker. And it's nice because it gives us proof that the drugs are working where we think they're working at the same time as we see kind of clinical evidence through proteinuria that they're ameliorating the outcome of the disease as well.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting point. You mentioned that, you know, not only is proteinuria kind of crude, but, you know, I remember when all the SGLT2 inhibitor data first came out to show its benefit in you know, cardiac and renal outcomes, you know, there were then all the dueling hypotheses of why is this even happening? And it's really nice to see something starting from the genetics and the real disease pathogenesis, and then the intervention, you know, being able to demonstrate that the intervention is doing what you think it's doing through a real biomarker. Maybe that even could help in terms of identifying, you know, who's most likely to respond, right, based on
Absolutely.
These biomarkers. So, you know, we certainly covered a lot of ground here, including multiple drug classes to treat IgA nephropathy. To wrap things up, to what extent do you believe these developments will be generalizable to other glomerular diseases? Are there certain classes of drugs that are more likely to translate than others? Are there certain diseases that are sufficiently similar to IgA nephropathy such that this is likely, but others that are too distinct that this is unlikely?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, IgA nephropathy has a lot of sort of features in a way going for it as a disease to study as a model disease here. It's kidney limited. It's got not a lot of extra renal comorbidity. The patients with it or otherwise tend to be fairly healthy. And so there's these, and it's not that uncommon. You know, it's the most common, certainly primary glomerulonephritis. So there's a large patient population, especially a large prevalent patient population who's been biopsied and have had the disease for years, where you can look at studying and employing drugs. So those types of aspects are really unique to IgA nephropathy. There's other similar diseases where you can see some overlapping types of features that might be interesting to study. For example, Alport's, which is mostly kidney limited, affects young people, has no drugs to treat it. I could see some of the same approaches, but the pathophysiology of Alport's is very different. So you'd need perhaps drugs that work at the end of glomerular damage, like perhaps endothelin antagonists. Certainly SGLT2 inhibitors could be worth studying in that patient population. And then there's some other diseases like the membranous nephropathy, for example, an autoimmune disease of antibody production, where you might be interested in targeting antibody production, but they very different pathogenesis from IgA nephropathy, much more simple pathogenesis in a way, where you're just trying to stop in the treatment of it, the production of antibodies. So I think there's less overlap there. And then FSGS it's not as well defined as IgA nephropathy because of the many, many different types of conditions which lead to the FSGS lesion on the biopsy. FSGS is a really hard condition to study because it's not just one thing. You know, there's many different processes that produce it. And so as opposed to IgA nephropathy, there's a little bit more of a clear diagnosis and clear pathophysiology that leads up to it. So certainly in the kind of final common pathway drugs that target glomerular hyperfiltration, glomerular injury, I think there's a lot of opportunity there, and that will improve outcomes over the long term. And like in IgA nephropathy, it might make it more difficult, certainly for CKD outcomes, because it reduces it to study new drugs because it might reduce the base case expectations in a control arm. But that's, you know, in the end, that's what we want to do for everyone is improve base case expectations. So it's a problem we're going to have to deal with, and it's not a bad problem to have.
Right, but maybe to put a finer point on it, when you take a disease like membranous, you know, what is the likelihood that targeting APRIL or BAFF would, you know, reduce the antibody production, right? I think we're alluding to PLA2R, right? So, you know,
yeah,
to what
for
degree
example,
do you think that would impact that?
I mean, you know, you can get creative. There's a study going on now of rituximab and belimumab, which targets the BAFF pathway combined for membranous. So, you know, immunology is complex and one can get creative in thinking of different ways to use and repurpose drugs. Just targeting B cell activation alone, I mean, that's been done in lupus. So I think there's many, many ways to think of repurposing agents. And I think actually we should do this not just limited to glomerular disease. We can do this in thinking about many different types of diseases that where these mechanisms are at play. And actually, I ended my talk at the ASN highlighting a figure that was published in a genome-wide association study, which was published in Nature Medicine and done by Christoph Kirlik, my colleague at Columbia, and Ali Garabi, among many, many, many others. So this is a genome-wide association study of 40,000 patients and controls with IgA nephropathy. And when you look at these studies, I joke, it's 40,000 patients and controls and like 20,000 authors, of which I was one. So I don't take any credit because the author list is tremendous. But there's a figure in there that looks at the 30 loci identified associated with IgA nephropathy, the candidate target genes, the related druggable targets, and highlights the number of drugs that are already out there being used for other conditions, which you could conceive of using to target this pathway in IgA nephropathy. So I actually think we have to, as we develop these kind of new drugs, and the more specific they are, we really need to think of what pathways might be important in other diseases that share these pathways, even if they're not necessarily kidney diseases or they don't, you know, look the same. And it's an interesting figure to look at if you want to think, you know, creatively and futuristically about possibilities in medicine.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. So you've definitely given us some great insights and a lot to think about here. Where can people go to hear or read more from you?
Thank you. You can find me hard at work most of the time. So I am part of the Glomerular Center at Columbia University, and we see a lot of patients for second opinions. And if you're interested from a clinical side of things and you have a glomerular disease and you're interested in a second opinion, there's about five of us and we keep very, very busy. I tend to keep my lecturing and educator aspects of my career within nephrology. So I, you know, travel around doing grand rounds here and there and giving talks, and we put on CME courses. So if you're a nephrologist, we have a wonderful CME course every summer, the Columbia Renal Biopsy course, which is in its 45th or 46th year, which is a good way to spend a few days. And then several other CME courses throughout the year, particularly in glomerular disease. So if for a practitioner who wants to learn more, if you look at the Columbia University CME catalog, you'll see lots of opportunities to learn more about some of the things I've been talking about today.
Okay, great. So thank you for that. Thanks again to our guest and to you, the listener. Stay tuned for future episodes. We are aiming to interview at least one more expert to hear about their biggest non-IgA nephropathy takeaways from ASN Kidney Week and what to look out for in 2024. This was Biotech Matters presented by Blue Star Bioadvisors. Until next time, I'm Jeff Feinberg.